You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode. Our topic today is integrating faith and psychology, and our guest is Paul Diehl.
Yeah, and Paul is assistant professor of counselor education at State University of New York, Plattsburgh, and also author of the recent book with a few other folks, Bringing Spirituality and Religion into Counseling, a Model for Pluralist Practice, which is a bit of a mouthful, but if you find this conversation interesting, encourage you to pick up a copy of that if you want to do a bit of a nerd deep dive. And I mentioned this in the podcast, but Paul and I go way back. We've been friends for a long time, had lots of conversations around this, so hopefully you find it interesting as well.
And the real important part of integrating these things and maybe the barriers to it, how it's difficult, but it's also very important. And I just, there were a ton of lights flashing in my mind as we were talking today. So I'm looking forward to the episode and hoping you are too.
All right. Without further ado.
The idea is that we all have this thing called a self-concept. Unconsciously, we tell ourselves the story of who we are. And that story draws the limits around what is allowed and not allowed of the self. I think Jung offers us a more viable pathway forward because he's saying integration is a possibility. Here is someone who's finding a pathway forward between religion, spirituality, and psychology that doesn't sort of say, never the twain should meet.
Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Well, in full disclosure, I think we do have to start with the fact that, Paul, you and I, we go way back. And I like to say that up front.
You guys got into legal trouble at the same time too, right? Isn't that what happened?
Is
there a rating on this podcast, PG or R? I mean, what's the boundary? I should have asked that before we started.
And then nobody knew where you guys were for like a year or two.
That's a different part of our journey.
Yeah.
We are in the monastery.
That's a different podcast.
Yes.
Doing spiritual work.
Okay, so I wanted to say that in case that comes up later, just so it doesn't feel off if I bring up something personal about you that I know, but or vice versa. Let's start with this question though: what led you to want to spend your life studying the intersection of spirituality and psychology?
Yeah, geez, I mean this much of my life anyway. We'll see what lies ahead. You know, I was thinking about that question a little bit, and a sort of really unsatisfying answer came into my mind at first, which was, you know, I have no idea. And then I thought, well, okay, it must be karma, and that didn't quite feel satisfying either. So I the next thing that popped into my head really was an experience that I had, I don't know, probably as like maybe a 9 or 10 year old. I remember we were driving home from the Congregational Church in New England. I think it was a fall day. It felt like a fall day in my memory anyway. And Pastor Crichton, who was an Anglican from the UK, his British accent helped me stay awake during the sermons. He said something along the lines of how God had no beginning or end. And in my 9 or 10 year old brain, I think that was one of my earliest experiences of feeling baffled. kind of like in a stimulating, like playful way, like I just brushed up against the edge of some sort of mystery that I didn't know really existed before that. And driving home, I was in the passenger seat. I remember looking out the window at the forest, sort of awash in the you know, still somewhat early morning sunlight, and just feeling like this bafflement sort of growing and growing, you know. And I don't think I would have used this language then, obviously, but you know, it's like something either got into my bones in that moment or was awoken in me. And that's really been a sort of animating, I don't know, feeling, question, drive ever since then. And I think the two ways I've opted to explore that feeling of bafflement and mystery and wonder have been through psychology on the one hand, which, you know, has a lot of strengths in terms of its descriptive abilities to describe and understand human phenomena. And then religion and spirituality, which, you know, I think is, you know, I see it as sort of complementing that psychology in a way where it's still very conversant with the wonder and the mystery, but it's a little bit more prescriptive in terms of sort of saying what humans are for and, you know, what a full life might look like within community. And so, yeah, I think that's really where I have to start. It was this experience where I was just sort of hooked by the wonder, so to speak.
Well, you talk about those kind of going hand in hand, psychology and spirituality, religion, in sort of an integrative way for you. But I think historically, mm-hmm. at least I would just say not historically, because I don't think that's necessarily true. In the past 30 years within the tradition I grew up, mental mm-hmm. health and faith were almost seen at odds. Like they weren't, they didn't play nice together. It was sort of like you could choose one or the other. You could kind of go to counseling and think about mental health and think about emotional awareness and emotional health, or you could like have faith in Jesus. And doing both of those things at the same time didn't seem to jive.
And even, not to interrupt, but before you get to this, Paul, but there are elements of Christian counseling that amount to religious catechizing, really. And if you get the theology, if you get the thinking right, the problems go away. So yeah, they're sort of at odds, aren't they?
Or they have an uneasy relationship where one encroaches on the other or vice versa, like what Pete was saying. So how, in your experience, you know, kind of starting with this, seems like this journey where they were in harmony in your life and you kind of walked that road. How do you see that relationship?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I'd love to hear more about what the two of you did experience in terms of that interrelationship as well. But I think just to start, where your question takes me is, you know, coming up within sort of a mixture of the, you know, like some Calvinist influence from my dad, and then some Baptist influence from different college environments, and then the Jesuits, you know, like this whole sort of hodgepodge of influences. Definitely not a very purist theologian in that sense, but
it sounds like you need a therapist, actually.
Are you guys free after this?
I won't help you, but yeah, sure, I'll take your money.
You just offer your presence. Yeah.
I could do that.
Keep your eyes open too. That helps. But I would say that they did start off more integrated. But interestingly enough, I think as I grew up inside of religion and spirituality, that sort of organic harmony started to fray a little bit. And I'm trying to think about what did that. You know, I think it might have been, and I'm not sure how much to blame religion or if this is just a human thing, but I think what started to happen there is that this sense of the wondrous, all-powerful, sort of omniscient, omnipotent, the spiel, divinity, that was somehow out there and above, wasn't fitting with what I sort of experienced on that drive home as a kid, staring at the forest and staring at nature or sitting in nature. They started to sort of become splintered in a way. I guess you could say, if we're going to put some clunky terms on this, right, like transcendence and immanence, or the beyond and the here and now, started to be unhinged from each other in a way that wasn't particularly helpful. And what happened along with that was this idea that happiness or wellness or well-being, or you know, the different sorts of terms that mental health counseling are often trying to pursue. And I guess you could say, like, I think about what religion is trying to pursue and some of its ultimate aims in the Christian tradition, we might call that salvation or something like that. The chasm between salvation and wellness in the here and now started to expand. And like I said, I'm not sure how much to blame religion, or if that's just a developmental thing, you know, where as a kid, I'm learning about God, I'm still kind of black and white, you know, but it seemed like when there was a shift from this organic experiential presence I felt, and to the point where I had to start conceptualizing it, that in the conceptualization, the dichotomy started to open up between, you know, God and nature, or spirit and matter, or, you know, I don't know, spirit and flesh, however you want to sort of talk about it, God and man. And that sort of drove psychology and religion and spirituality further apart as well. And then it's been a sort of slow and intentional journey of putting those back together and really seeing how they complement each other.
If I can put it this way, Paul, if this is what you're saying, that you just had experiences that made those theological religious categories difficult to make any sense.
Yeah, like they're maybe a little out of alignment or something like that.
So they're not aligning, and so they start separating, but then you started thinking maybe synthetically about how they're connected. Is that where we're going?
Yeah, yeah. And you say, you know, you say not a counselor there, but those are two pretty good paraphrases. you know, I think it's you know, I'm just thinking about it off the top of my head, but you know, at some point along the way, there, because of the type of religious teaching that I experienced, the message was something along the lines of, you know, either implicitly or explicitly, that compartmentalization is your best option. And so in other words, this thing you want to call sin, or you know, whatever else that associates with, it's best to suppress it or just let go and let God, or you know, give it over, right? A lot of those cliches start to come to mind here in terms of my experience. And there wasn't really a viable pathway where someone said, so all this human messiness stuff that comes with being thrown into a human incarnation and having a human life is actually the material of salvation, of awakening, of grace. And you know, that material is, in fact, your teacher. And you can pay attention to it. You can learn from it. You can integrate it. That it will be painful. It will break you open at times and reframe your sense of what God is or what reality is or what it means to be, you know, in relationship with others. But that, like, you know, this is sort of a Richard Rohr thing, right? There's no remainder, is this sort of idea. There doesn't have to be a remainder. There's room for everything in that integration process. And psychology, sometimes we call this the shadow, you know, and one of the things I like about the Gnostics in particular is because they seem to be a little more inclined to want to work with shadow, what I think of as like a psycho-spiritual approach rather than a traditional like biblical hermeneutic. And I'm out of my depths now. I said hermeneutic, so. But, you know, there's sort of the psycho-spiritual sense where I think, you know, and the Gnostic Gospels, maybe the Gospel of Thomas it was, Jesus said something like, you know, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. And if you don't bring it forth, what you don't bring forth will destroy you. And that's really the bridge for me to see how psychology and spirituality and religion can really work together insofar as they can bring forth what is within us. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's interesting because we see these impulse. I feel like in some ways the Gnostic Gospels, Gospel of Thomas and other of these writings, we see these impulses maybe in the New Testament, but they're not fully fleshed out. And so they're ambiguous. And so you can take it one way or you can take it another way. Like there's a way to read Paul, for instance, where it is Christ in you, the hope of glory. There's this sort of, you have the resources within you to contribute to the world and to be whole and to be well. And then you could read Paul to say, there's nothing good in you and you need Jesus. And that's all the good that you have comes from Jesus. It's like, well, which is it? And so there's these different traditions. Is that one way in which this split between mental health and faith happens is if we read Paul in a way that divorces those things, then we're going to lead to thinking that when psychology, I remember growing up hearing this phrase a lot, psychobabble. Right. That whenever psychology says that you have these resources within you, that is psychobabble. That is secularism, whatever the term we wanted to use.
Denying.
But when you say, I am not good at all, and I can get better only when I accept that I'm not good and that Jesus is all the good that will ever come into my life, then that's like the path to true healing. But there is, I just want to name, like, it may be very explicit in the Gospel of Thomas, but I think there is this sense in which it's there in the New Testament as well, but it's maybe harder to parse out. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
Can I add something to that, Paul?
Because keep interrupting.
Because we're having a conversation here, Jared. Do you know what a conversation is? A conversation is when I talk whenever I want to. That's what a conversation is. What do you think of that, Paul?
The spirit's moving now.
There's something that you said before, and then Jared responded, and I'm putting a piece together. I'm just throwing it out there. Mm. You said something very helpful, and that's intuitively true, that the messiness is the teacher. Mm. I think, you know, Jared is quoting something from Paul about Christ in us. I think that's a little bit different, in my opinion, because that's still Christ in you. But you're saying something different. Your approach is very integrative, like all of us, every part of us, unless we're pathological, I'm assuming, but you know, every part of us moves us towards healing, towards wholeness. Which, you know, there are other people who talk like that. It's making more sense to me, you know, the older I get and think about these things. But, you know, who we are is fine and good, and that the insights don't need to come from read this psalm again, which is some things that I've heard in my life and others have heard too.
Yeah, same.
So, you know, maybe and one sort of intersection between that insight, the messiness is the teacher, is how, I'm asking rhetorically at this point, we'd have to get into this, but how does a view of the divine, how can we conceive of the divine that works with that, so to speak, that it's not an either or, it's not two sides and you have to choose one, but maybe, you know, more traditional, maybe Christian language, the presence of God in your messiness and working in it and through it.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's really the journey, to say something sort of played out. But I mean, that's the journey of a lifetime. And I, you know, as I was listening, the distinction you drew, I think maybe there's even a bridge between that in terms of how I think about it. But this idea that the messiness is the teacher on the one hand and Christ in us on the other hand, and this is more of a psycho-spiritual framing, but Christ in me is the space from which I can approach the messiness without shame, without self-condemnation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a Buddhist, you might call it Buddha mind. You know, if you're a Hindu, you might call it Atman, right? There's different terms. If you're a Jungian, you might call it capital S self. But there's these different terms that are both sort of, you know, you could say innate potentials that exist within us and outside of us as part of the communion of saints, so to speak, that we can tap into and access and learn from. And I, you know, even to hear myself say this, I know this is a dangerous territory, because I can think back to some of the earlier conversations or things I heard about, okay, well, you have to be dangerous there about getting puffed up. You know, I mean, you have to be careful there about becoming puffed up or too confident in your own abilities. And I think that fear that, you know, sometimes come out of certain types of religious or spiritual traditions about going inward, you know, it's in some ways it's fair. It's well founded. You know, there's such a thing as a lot of navel gazing psychotherapy that doesn't successfully turn its gaze outward. And yet at the same time, I think that fear goes back to the, being taught a theology that says there's nothing good in the shadow, where in the psycho-spiritual literature, it says there's gold in the shadow. In fact, you need to, find the courage, ask for the courage, develop a community that can help you sort of integrate that stuff from time to time, because when it's not. And I can tell you this from having worked as a psychotherapist in various religious and spiritual environments, when it's not integrated, it erupts. It erupts in an affair. It erupts in, you know, substance abuse. It erupts in all sorts of things. So the alternative to integrate is difficult.
Can we get really practical with that language, Paul? Because I think that's a really good point about being able to integrate the shadow. And that those are conceptual terms, but for practical people, like, I really appreciate how you got real. Like, no, it can erupt in not abstract things. It can erupt in, you know, disruptions in relationship and substance abuse and these kinds of things. So when we talk in shadow, what are we talking?
So, you know, this was sort of a, you know, just a quick primer. Freud originally thought of the unconscious as just this cauldron of sort of seething, instinctual, animal-like tendencies. And the cost of living in a society was learning how to sort of, in large part, you know, I don't know about repress, but sort of like come to terms with the fact that you need to develop a superego strong enough to sort of say no to those things and put them in perspective and sort of draw boundaries and learn when it's okay to express an urge and not to. Jung came along, and this is a big part why, and I'm speaking of Carl Jung here, you know, the Swiss-Austrian psychoanalyst. He came along and sort of said, okay, I think Freud's conception of the shadow is a bit too depraved. And he sort of said the shadow is actually just this place where all this underdeveloped, immature stuff lives. It's not necessarily negative. It's not inherently bad. What makes it, quote unquote, bad is that it's immature, you know, and it's in the task, the journey of life is to learn how to mature it. And how do you mature it? You bring it into conscious awareness so you can learn how to work with it. And so Jung, I think Jung offers us a more viable pathway forward because he's saying, you know, integration is a possibility. And there's a reason why, you know, a lot of the Jesuits I studied with in my degree were Jungians, because I think they were intuiting, here is someone who's finding a pathway forward between religion, spirituality, and psychology that doesn't sort of say, you know, never the twain should meet. They're just different, you know, different schools of thought, and we're sort of stuck with that. So I don't know if that clarifies it.
Well, I just want to clarify, when you say the shadow, though, like, it could be as simple as I'm extremely angry at my mom for this thing that I've sort of inherited as a pattern. But instead of being able to bring that to consciousness and name it and to work with it, I pretend it doesn't exist because in my tradition, to be angry at my mom is like this mortal sin. And so I can't even acknowledge it because it means I'm a horrible human being and then shame comes in and all that. Is that an example?
It's a great example, yeah. The idea is that we all have this thing called a self-concept. Unconsciously, we tell ourselves the story of who we are. And that story draws the limits around what is allowed and not allowed of the self. And if anger by your religious, spiritual tradition or even just your family culture, whatever it is considered outside the self-concept, it would then have to be repressed and you would never develop skillfulness around it. But I think it's important to note there's also something called the golden shadow, where we may also, because of our conditioning, family, culture, or otherwise, repress and push away. You know, the emphasis on golden, I guess, is like there's these really positive attributes. So you might have someone, because of their early childhood, that learned that it was never safe to let them be loved, to let their guard down, to experience vulnerability and intimacy. And so later on in life, they really push that stuff away. They keep their guard up. And their journey for them is similar, but it's working with this golden shadow aspect of, okay, how do I learn how to let myself be loved in certain circumstances where that's safe and I can take the risk for fuller life with this person or in this community. So the shadow is really, it's dynamic. It's not just the anger. It's also these sort of, you know, bright qualities, so to speak.
We're complicated people, aren't we? You know, something you said before, Paul, about Jung and how he said that Freud's idea of the shadow was too depraved. Yeah. And, you know, right away, Christian language comes to mind. And, you know, and this just may help people get attached to it. This is maybe Jung reacting, I know very little about Jung in terms of, you know, professionally, but I seem to recall that his father was a Calvinist minister and his uncles were, and it was sort of in the family. And he just found that to be all too depressing and not really helping to explain people, right? So I just think the word depraved, that may have been your word, but it may have been something that maybe Jung was thinking as well, that this is a really dark, this is almost, Freud's too Calvinistic. And again, I'm not picking on Calvinists yeah. here. I'm really not. But it's that utter darkness and uselessness of our interiority or of our interior world has proved not to be helpful for people and how they think about themselves and the people around them and their place on this earth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe Jung is getting to some of those things. Again, that's somebody that I don't really understand. I wish I knew him better, but and that's language. I mean, that I think, you know, in other words, maybe something like total depravity, every aspect of you is depraved. Depraved is a very strong word. From a psychological point of view, it's hard to have an integrative approach to faith and mental health when the theology says your inner world is just a dark place and it needs to be pushed down, confessed, or just ignored, but not to see what lessons can be learned from the stuff that's happening inside of you you don't want to talk to anybody about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a good point. And I've had clients that upon being invited to reframe that total depravity, have really resisted it despite the depression. You know, I guess that's what I'd call, you know, depravity from a psychological perspective, maybe a deep depression where there's just constant thoughts of worthlessness, mm-hmm. and I'm easy to reject and there's no point putting myself out there, you know, and the lethargy and lack of pleasurable experience that comes with that. And so when it gets deeply ingrained, and this is sort of, I guess, bleeding into this territory, which is, I think, also really complex in the psychology field or pastoral counseling field, is, you know, how do we as pastoral counselors adjudicate between what counts as healthy and unhealthy religion and spirituality, given mm-hmm. that sometimes what a client comes in with is not just their own religion and spirituality, but that's been a conditioned thing that their religious or spiritual subgroup teaches every week, or a version of it, right? And mm-hmm. so you don't work with the client by challenging or undermining the very teaching of their religious subculture.
Yeah.
At least not right away. there's a lot of work before that, but it's hard. I think it's a great point. And when that really gets into someone's bones, it can be a hard thing to shed.
Well, one very quick anecdote. Again, I only say this maybe if people can relate to it. When one of my children years ago was in a therapeutic context in her teens, and she was beating herself up for not being good enough, and mm-hmm. one of the therapists mentioned to her that, "You believe in God, don't you?" And she said, "Yeah." And he says, "Don't you know that you're of eternal worth?" And I still get emotional thinking about that, because she had been in church her whole life and never once heard that. And that has to do, again, with, it's not like the problem of religion in psychology. It's the problem that some theologies might cause in integrating those two things. And for those theologies to survive, you have to keep them separate, I think. I don't know, Jared, if you agree with that, but you have to. They simply don't play well together unless the psychology side of it is tamed and adjusted in such a way that it can serve the theology instead of, maybe, dare I say, critiquing it, which is a no-no, Jared, right? That's where we came from. That's just, you don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the... And what maybe to tie those two together, Paul, what kind of you were saying a second ago is... When is it that the theology is elastic enough to contain some of these insights from psychology and things that we're learning, right? We do this all the time with, say, science. When is the theology elastic enough to say, you know what, we've kind of garnered enough evidence to say evolution is true. And so we got to kind of shift and resize this theology to fit it. And when is it just not going to work? And we actually just have to reject this thing. Mm-hmm. And I just think a lot of people are in that place of wondering, can my theology, my reading of the Bible, the reading of Jesus, this whole Christianity thing, can it be resized in a way that will accept what seems true to me living in our day and age about the human mind, what leads us to flourish, or can it not? And it sounds like, you know, as pastoral counselors, you guys, you have to kind of figure that out on the fly almost in these settings of when are we critiquing the system or when are we able to maybe adjust kind of the expectations.
Well said. And there is some literature that helps guide that. You know, for example, there's some constructs that talk about assessing a person's religion and spirituality and when it looks like they're in a place of what is called like religious or spiritual conservation versus religious or spiritual mm-hmm. transformation. And so in the former, it's where the life issue has not sufficiently started to cause the foundations of the person's theology and religious identity to break apart. In other words, the religion of spirituality is still mostly working. It's able to help them, it's called religious conservation in the sense that it's still effective at helping them conserve a sense of meaning. And so the intervention in those cases is often to ask the client, for example, you know, like, is there a scripture here that comes to mind that really feeds you and that may be helpful in this moment? And then still we may need to assess, like, if they bring up a scripture that's supposed to, you know, like validate the fact that they are beloved by the divine and they bring up, you know, something from Job or something, we still want to maybe do some sort of assessing there to find out like, okay, I wonder why they chose that particular text in that moment. And in the case of spiritual religious transformation, that's where there's evidence that the religious meaning-making system is breaking down. It's not working anymore. And sometimes we call that they're entering a psycho-spiritual crisis. And those moments are always really exciting for me. And I don't mean that in a flippant way, but because that's that moment where the person gets to sort of step outside of their theology back into the terror and wonder of being a human and start to construct something anew. You know, I've committed that I think it's the final line in Tillich's Courage to Be, because it so resonates on this matter.
That's, you know, Paul Tillich, right?
Yeah,
Paul,
yeah,
the theologian.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the courage to be is rooted in the God who appears after God has disappeared in the anxiety of doubt. And that there may be, you know, throughout a lifetime, the death of numerous God concepts over time, but it takes a really safe holding space for a client to enter into that. It's a sacred space where, you know, in a collaborative way, something new is being born in the client. It's often very painful and filled with a lot of anxiety. And it's,
The anxiety is, I mean, that's, again, not to be simplistic, but, mm-hmm. you know, we have people in our lives, and Jared and I understand this existentially as well, that transformative place, mm-hmm. that crisis place, I guess, that stepping away from what you know and what you believe into this exciting world where you have no idea and you're still going to reinvent yourself. The whole purpose of true religious faith is to make sure that never happens, right? So, I mean, that's the tension I think people feel with that even being in a space where you embrace this, I guess we're talking about maybe disorientation or deconstruction. That's language that people might know better. I don't know if you're comfortable using that language, but mm-hmm. that is like you have to have a certain religious structure that allows that to happen. Maybe the only way to do it is just to be thrown into it, you know, and sort of sink or swim. I don't know. But my point is that there are barriers for people that are theological, but they're also, I guess, psychological in that sense. Both sides are affected. That makes it very difficult to look positively at this wonderful yet also frightening time of transformation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really fair. You know, whether it's from a psychological or a theological framework, it's just the experience of being alive to that edge of, you know, and I, thinking back to what you said, Jared, about support in the New Testament, you know, the verse that comes to mind for me is, I think it's John 10:10. I come that they may have life and life to the fullest. And like you said, that could be interpreted in two different ways, right? But if we're interpreting it in terms of life to the fullest in the here and now, I think of this sense of aliveness. And it takes a lot of resources to be present to that aliveness. And it's a living faith, which is riding that edge where life is about learning and growth. And anytime I start talking like this, I'm immediately aware of the immense privilege that goes into being able to talk like this, right? None of us here are in survival mode. Yeah. Our material needs are met. We've been blessed in a lot of ways in that way, or maybe lucky, if you want to think about it. But yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of resistance to that. And it's just, I think, a human thing, right? This is scary. This is hard. But if we have a framework that says, no, this is actually the journey, it gets a little easier, right? It gets just a little bit easier to say, oh, wait, other people have tread this path too. I'm in good company.
Yeah.
Well, I want to come back, Paul, to this idea that this elasticity idea of how can people who, you know, what are ways that you've seen for people who want to continue down their faith tradition? They want to continue to be Christian, and yet they need to make room for things like, it's okay to work on your shadow side. It's okay not to think of yourself as innately evil, and, you know, that you can be good in our core as human beings and yet still have things to work on and enter into that messiness. Like, what are some steps or processes or ways of thinking or concepts that you've seen that help people step into that without it? What we've seen is sometimes it feels like a betrayal, like they're almost cheating on their Christianity by entertaining
these psychological adultery, right?
Yeah. Insights. And how do people maybe move beyond that?
Yeah. I'm hearing myself sigh just processing that question. I mean, that's such an important one. And I think there's a lot of different things I can say, but the thing that's sort of come to the forefront of my mind is actually that in order for it to really take, to be something that doesn't just park in the mind, it actually translates into the heart and the body, I think it has to be experienced. It has to be felt. And, you know, for me, that's where something like a practice, you know, Christianity calls it a prayer life or contemplative practices. Other traditions call it meditation. And that I think those are perhaps spaces where a person, by becoming still, and there, you know, there's certain persons that, let's say, like with a real serious chronic depression, right? Maybe that stillness would be contraindicated because there's going to just be an onslaught of negative self-talk, or, you know, if the tradition, I'd even call it like demonic voices or something like that. So it's not for everyone, but I do feel very strongly about the sense that it needs to be experienced. And maybe what helps that happen is to first experience it with another mm-hmm. human being. Because there's a lot of clients, and this goes back to a lot of theory around attachment, folks who are quote unquote, like they say, you can be insecurely attached. So in other words, there's not this sort of basic internalization of safety and co-regulation in your being that a young infant learns. And, you know, more and more we're learning that the primacy of early development is really key. Everything gets built on that foundation of what's happening in your own nervous system and your neural pathways. And if that space is charged with anxiety and tension, fear and betrayal and abandonment, it doesn't matter what you learn intellectually about that God, what your God concept is, the God image, the God that lives in your being, is not a safe God. You know, and there's a lot of theory that talks about how the mom and dad or whoever our caregivers are sort of like the first quote unquote gods of our lives. And we internalize our ways of relating and perceiving the divine through that imprinting, through those attachment bonds. But I think where the therapy relationship can be powerful, or, you know, with a pastor or a mentor or whoever it is, but it comes back to this idea of like presence and unconditional positive regard, we call it in the psychology field, you know, in Christianity, you might call it unconditional love. And I think those are sort of highfalutin terms. So maybe an easier way to say it is, if someone gets to experience the gift of sitting with someone that needs absolutely nothing from them, doesn't need them to think that they're smart or talented or good looking or special, but just has this presence that they can offer for whatever depths or degrees of human messiness might show up, and can get their own stuff out of the way enough, because there's always stuff that's going to come up as you're sitting with someone, but to sort of see it when it comes up, sort of bracket it and say, okay, well, I know what that is. That's my own ego needing this or that or the other. How do I come back to this presence with this person? I think it's in that dyadic interpersonal relationship where that experience of love becomes internalized. And that might be the birth of a divine love that was missing.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to test this with you, because lately I've been thinking of it as kind of the unconditional okayness. Like what I want to offer people when I sit with them is just an okayness. Hey, so when they tell me their shocking, shame-filled, deep thoughts, I'm like, okay. When they, you know, tell me these sorts of things, it's like, okay. Like, just to offer a space where they're what they expect from another human being to hear these things that they've built up in their heads, and to have someone say, yeah, you know, probably lots, I've had same thoughts, or yeah, it seems pretty normal to me.
Mm-hmm.
Can just be a really powerful thing, because, I think for me, the okayness of it, because I also don't like to over-aggrandize it, I guess, where it's like, you have to think that, like, I have to sit here and lie to you and say you're the best human being in the world. When you have trouble, you have shadow, like, because in some ways, I call it positive gaslighting. Again, this is me just making up psychological terms. But when it's like you're trying to overly inflate someone, and they just, you're kind of asking them to go against their own intuitions, which is like, no, you kind of are a shitty person sometimes. Like, you do kind of bad things sometimes, right? Not so being able to say, like, I guess for me, it's not an over-aggrandizing, because then that also can neglect the shadow side in the opposite way. And so to kind of have a more neutral sense of, you're okay, like, and maybe that's what you mean by positive regard. Maybe that's kind of the psychological framework of, it's not that you're great and perfect. It's not that you're horrible and would outside of redemption. It's that you're like me, which means we're okay.
You're human.
You're human.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's a long way of saying that.
I like that. I think it fits. And a little bit of the, you know, the positive regard is sort of like, it's a way of being or relating to the other person. So I'm going to regard you in a positive way. Radical acceptance, radical compassion, you know, unconditional okayness. These are all terms we could put on that. And if you don't validate the shitty side, as you said, it doesn't work. Ironically, for a lot of people, they'd be like, oh, you're just brushing past that. Like, it's got to be a both and, right? To both sort of say, like, wow, that's some heavy, intense stuff. And welcome to the club.
Yeah. Well, we were, we're talking about practical kinds of steps or outlooks to this. And, you know, both of you were talking about sitting with somebody else, with other people, which I really agree with very strongly. And it's sort of like you see God in other people. But when you're conditioned to just sort of pray it away, so to speak, in isolation, and sometimes talking to another human being is like the hardest thing you could possibly ever
right.
do. Because that's actually, now you're voicing the betrayal. When you keep it inside, there's a hope that no one will find out. No, you can keep it hidden from everyone. But I'm just saying this as an observation, that it's that first step is very, very difficult for some people to make, because that is exactly the evidence that they're going off the deep end and they're beyond hope.
Mm.
So they keep it inside and have cognitive dissonance, or like you said, Paul, it sort of erupts in different ways.
Yeah.
Or the idea that it's not real unless you say it.
Right. Yeah. So I guess, I mean, the question is, how do you get to a point where you feel comfortable actually talking to somebody else? And I really am asking that rhetorically, unless you want to feel you can answer. I think that's a hard question to answer. Like, it's almost like you have to be sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you just, I just have to do something. It doesn't matter what it is. So maybe, you know, a private thing with a therapist, for example, or a spiritual advisor where they don't know you, that may be one way to do it. You know, it's professional and nobody has to know that.
Confidential.
Confidential, yeah. Right, as mm-hmm. opposed to talking to one of your buddies at church or something.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, or what I found myself saying to classes at times, and I think I actually believe this, even just based on my own life experience, like it's been, you know, my sense is that most of us go kicking and screaming, right? You know, it took 4 deaths in a matter of 5 years. You know, this is after getting a mm-hmm. PhD in pastoral counseling to get me back into counseling, where I was really willing to like look at some of the oldest stuff that I'd, you know, some of which I'd forgotten. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is I think it takes a point where the suffering of avoidance starts to outweigh the suffering of facing it.
That's well put. Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
And, you know, that comes for us in all different forms. mm-hmm. You know, it could be a panic attack, could be losing a job, it could be explosion of various symptoms, you know, relationship problems. And again, these are the teachers. If we can listen and have a framework that says this isn't just sin or persecution, or, you know, that this is actually part of the path.
And not to be the Sunday school teacher to kind of bring this back around for the Bible for normal people, but I guess what I want to say, and Paul, I'd appreciate your insight on this, but the way we've been talking the last whatever half hour, 40 minutes, it's like I can imagine the critics from my childhood of like, well, they didn't even talk about the Bible. They didn't talk about, you know, Jesus in this. And so how are we even talking about this being Christian in any significant way? And I think for me, it comes back to what we do here on this podcast. You know, what is the Bible? What do we do with it? The Bible was written in a context where this was not the language or insights that were used or had been discovered yet, or we didn't have this language. And so that doesn't mean that the Bible is irrelevant to it, but it does mean that we might need to infuse the Bible with new ways of understanding and taking things like, I appreciate what you said about John 10:10. There is a way to infuse John 10:10 with a more contemporary, robust understanding of psychological significance. And so it takes work, but every generation has to do that work anew. And so I just think it's not, again, that impulse of thinking these as separate things doesn't have to be the case. There is a way then to go to take all these insights and to learn from them and grow in them, and then to go back to the Bible and say, you know what, there's a way of reading this that actually gives me life now. And sometimes we're too close to it to see it that way. We either want to reject it, you know, because it represents a painful past, or we just stay within the framework of it has to mean this one thing. So I don't know if you found that with clients or just in your experiences, is this isn't apart from the Bible. There is a way to breathe new life into it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. But you do have to be really careful with that. It's sort of a timing and dosage thing, and find ways in. And I find it to be incredibly difficult with certain types of clients. There's a lot of patience involved in the process. And, you know, as I was listening, part of what came to mind, and I don't know if this is from, I was thinking about one of the books of yours, Pete, I read a while ago. I gave it to my dad, so I don't remember what it was called now, but it had a yellow cover.
The Bible Tells Me So, or I think, yeah.
Yeah,
the yellow one, that's how I refer to my book. Yeah, my titles are too long, so the yellow one.
But anyway, I think part of, you know, what it came to mind as I was listening to you talk, Jared, because I feel like one of the things that's important I took away from that book that I hadn't considered really before is that, and maybe you didn't say this, Pete, maybe it's just what I projected onto it or needed to hear or needed to think to keep moving forward myself, was that, like, yes, the words of the biblical texts sort of are finished and entombed in that book we all carry around with us, but the Bible is still happening, right, in a way, or the gospel is still still happening in a way, maybe, that the living word is that we are still the people of God living out this constantly unfolding sort of narrative and all that messiness and redemption. And I think, you know, that's a really heretical idea, I imagine, in certain circles. And I don't know a way around that other than hoping that maybe some part of a person has fertile soil where those seeds might like take hold at some point.
I mean, there are so many, I think, interesting and life-giving and dynamic ways of integrating, you know, our emotional lives and our religious, theological lives, provided you're open to the idea of integrating those two in a meaningful way, and maybe even in a creative way. And the struggle, I think, is that there are some people who desperately want to do that, but they're in a place where, again, the very integration is the problem. And I think it's hard to get around that. And you know, I can think of people and, you know, how'd you get to the point where you decided to sort of step from, you know, a conservation mode and sort of embrace this transformation mode? And very often they don't really have a good answer, and that's fine. They just woke up one morning and they said it makes sense. You know, so it might take people their own time and place to get to that place, you know, where that fertile soil starts blooming a bit. And but many don't, you know, and you can't force it, I guess. But there are many who deep down probably feel stuck a bit, and they don't know which way to go. And there's no formula to make that work quickly if your religious life has shielded you from even paying attention to that sort of thing. The power of religion, you know, it really is. It's, well, you know, let me just, not just religion, but I think any ideology can keep you from looking at the shadow, if that's one way of summarizing a lot of this stuff. So,
and that's the religion that, to be fair, Freud was attacking.
Yes, right, right.
Right. He wasn't attacking this other stuff we're talking about. He was sort of close to it too, because he had his own baggage he hadn't sorted out. But you know, that's what he was attacking, and Nietzsche was attacking, and Marx was attacking, all the folks.
So for those who, kind of as we wrap up our time, Paul, for those who have this tension within them, what might be just kind of a first step or a few kind of thoughts on how to dip their toes into a world where they don't have to hold this tension anymore, giving them a little bit of a leg up on a few things that might help?
Yeah. I mean, maybe this is coming to mind just because of where our conversation has been today, but I think just to consider the possibility, like to be willing to give oneself permission to consider the possibility that the quote unquote hard stuff, quote unquote bad stuff is a teacher, that it may actually be one of the languages of grace. And that maybe gets really complicated real quick, but you know, just more basically that the materials for transformation may be living right inside of us if we have the space, the courage, the support, definitely the support, the permission to sort of turn towards them and say, okay, well, what do you have? Like, what do you have for me here? And maybe most importantly, like from within a framework that says, this is part of the gig, you know, like this is part of being human. And maybe, right, like we know Christ went to the desert, we know Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, and they were faced with all this really hard stuff, right? Power, temptation, lust, greed, whatever, right? And that turning towards and being present to that stuff, seeing what's there, you know, not drowning in it necessarily, although that may happen at times. That's where self-compassion is important. But to be able to sort of turn towards it and say, okay, this is part of the gig. And I think, you know, just as a like basic psychology idea, when we turn towards and begin to, you know, like this systematic desensitization is what's used for certain phobias and stuff like that. When we turn towards and we recognize that wave of fear or panic or shame or whatever else move through us with a little bit of distance, and this takes skills to do, or it takes the presence of someone else that has those skills and can sort of be with us through it, that we can start to change our relationship to that stuff and get on that path, mm-hmm. because it doesn't really ever end. I don't think there's always another curveball around.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question. I sort of rambled there, but that's sort of what comes to mind, Jared.
Mm. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for coming on. And I think this is it really is a huge topic that I think is going to be more and more relevant to people as more people continue to go through these faith shifts and start to figure out what it kind of means for them and how they think of themselves and their, you know, that kind of psychological element.
And permission to do something about mm-hmm. it, maybe too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, fellas. This was fun.
Thank you, Paul.
See ya.
Yeah, be well.
You just made it through another entire episode of The Bible for Normal People. Well done to you. And well done to everyone who supports us by rating the podcast, leaving us a review, or telling others about our show. We are especially grateful for our producers group who support us over on Patreon. They are the reason we are able to keep bringing podcasts and other content to you. So a big thanks to Mark and Karen Bower, Jamie Edwards, Andre Morgan III, Drew Nelson, Karen Files, Emma Wyatt, Ryan Bruckner, Sarah Boyd, Meisen Heidelberg, Timothy Rink, Megan Selbach-Allen, and Ashley Soto. If you would like to help support the podcast, head over to patreon.com/thebibleformalpeople, where for as little as $3 a month, you can receive bonus material, be part of an online community, get course discounts, and much more. We couldn't do what we do without your support.
Our show is produced by Stephanie Spate, audio engineer Dave Gerhardt, creative director Tessa Stoltz, community champion Ashley Ward, and web developer Nick Striegel. Copyright 2021, The Bible for Normal People. All rights reserved. In other words,
no copying or you're in big trouble.
For Pete, Jared, and the entire Bible for Normal People team, thanks for listening.
Can I add something to that, Paul?
Because I keep interrupting.
Because we're having a conversation here, Jared. Do you know what a conversation is? A conversation is when I talk whenever I want to. That's what a conversation is.